Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It's Thursday, May 9th, and Nurses Week, just want you to know. I keep saying that. I'm going to, just to let you know, we're going to hear House Bill 2902A, and it's an extremely important bill, but it we're going to limit it to 40 minutes. And so 20 minutes for the proponents first, and then 20 minutes for people with other points of view. All right. With that, I'd open a public hearing on House Bill 2902. And Sandy, bring us up to date.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2902A requires insurers to reimburse physician assistants and nurse practitioners in independent practice at the same rate as physicians for the same services. And the bill also defines independent practice. This left the House floor with 39 ayes, 20 noes, one excused. There's no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact on the A and gross, Madam Chair.
Excellent. And I have a little timer, and 20 minutes, it's going to go off as soon as you guys start speaking. All right. Susan King, Max Tencher? Is it Tencher?
Tencher.
And Madeline Simmons.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Nurses Association. I provide staff support to the Nurse Practitioners of Oregon, one of our special interest groups. Just a brief review before I hand the comments over to my colleagues. In 2012, the Senate passed a somewhat different version of this bill that would have affected a broader population of nurse practitioners, those not only in primary care but in specialty care as well. This bill, differently, only applies to NPs and PAs in primary care and those providing mental health services and who bill under their own name and national provider identification number. The policy is straightforward, at least in our opinion. Private insurers would be required to pay the same amount when the services are billed using the same codes as physicians. This isn't a contest. I want to be very clear. This is not a contest with our physician colleagues. We value them. We know that our primary care and mental health capacity is stressed already, and with full implementation of healthcare reform, we're going to need even more capacity. This bill should not, and it is not our intention that it affects physicians in any way. It certainly does not change scope of practice for any provider. It simply corrects what are inconsistent policies of some, and I would emphasize some insurance carriers, and prevents the unilateral reimbursement decisions that they're making that are not based on either quality or cost. Those carriers who paid the same currently for the same services as determined by the procedure, treatment, and service codes would not be affected by this bill. Many NPs and PAs continue to be reimbursed at the full rate or the same rate as their physician colleagues. Our best estimate that this bill would has already, or this practice has already, impacted about 10 to 20% of nurse practitioners in the state of Oregon, which, based on our best evidence, we estimate at about 200 to 400 of those in practice. Just a quick review, this issue became most acute when a carrier made a decision to reduce payments to all non-physician psych mental health providers, approximately 25%. This occurred in 2009. A second carrier that then won the contract for the same patient population made an additional 25% cut. Thus, some of the NPs sustained a 50% reduction in reimbursement for a large percentage of their population. The outcome of those reimbursement cuts, although not universal, some NPs have restricted their practice, others have reduced their hours, and both of those actions have an impact on access to care. Cuts have been made across the state in rural, urban, and many areas in between. I would just like to emphasize that this policy contained in the bill is consistent with the stated goals of the Oregon healthcare reform, which many commercial carriers have endorsed. Shifting healthcare delivery from expensive acute care to primary care homes where a relationship can be established between provider and patient over time is our stated goal. Given our emphasis on expanding primary and mental health care capacity, this bill is structured to focus specifically on those two portions of our delivery system. ONA strongly supports comprehensive payment reform, including global budgeting and capitation, depending on how they're implemented, of course. We look forward to a system that is outcomes-based as well. This bill, as a result, addresses problems with the current system and should be considered a short-term solution until we achieve a significant payment reform. Finally, we wish that the carriers would have solved this problem on their own, and we met with them in order to try to achieve that. However, given their lack of evidence and articulated rationale for reimbursement decisions and unwillingness to change their policies, this bill is coming to you. Again, it restores full reimbursement, enhancing access to primary and mental health care, and treating NPs and PAs fairly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Monis Anderson, good to see you again. And members of the committee, I appreciate your consideration of this topic. I think it's a very important one. My name's Max Tencher. I'm a family nurse practitioner. I've been practicing in Oregon since 1991. I've practiced in a variety of settings, including with a small doctor of osteopathic practice in a rural health center in Vernonia, Oregon, and most recently for the past 10 years in my own practice, which is an integrative primary care practice in downtown Portland in Northwest. I am also in the process of opening a satellite clinic in Talent, Oregon. A rural community, and it's interesting to see the differences between what's happening in the urban areas and the rural areas. And I think the consideration of the matter before you is of extreme importance in both areas, perhaps more in the rural areas. The practice that I hold in Portland includes two nurse practitioners other than myself. It includes a physician who trained at OHSU. It includes a psychologist. It includes some evidence-based alternatives, including acupuncture and biofeedback. And speaking to Susan King's input about primary care homes, that's what we've been doing. And I have patients that I've been seeing in the Portland metro area for the past 15 years who continue to come to that practice. And it's the relationship that definitely defines the quality of care and the ability to make good decisions about long-term options for patients. In our practice, each of us, whether nurse practitioner or physician, sees our own patient panel. We do communicate between one another, but it's both ways. I will go to my physician colleague and ask about specific things, and she will come to me and ask about others. It's a very pleasant relationship. I'm very happy to have her there. There have been years in my practice where I practiced without a physician in my practice. I like both ways. One of the goals in my practice was cooperation and community, and hence we have a number of different providers working together on patient issues. I believe that if we're looking at the health care of all Oregonians, we need to look at who's delivering the care and where it's being delivered, and that we can maintain those systems as they are, as financially viable entities. I'm concerned that with what I saw happen with the mental health reimbursements, that if that were to take place in primary care, that some of these innovative models, some of these cooperative practices would not exist, and that the rural underserved areas would be increasingly underserved. I think as healthcare reform continues, we'll only see more impact in these areas. The projection has been 5,000 to 8,000 new people on the rolls. It will be interesting to see where we find all the primary care people to handle this. I'm hoping that with parity, we can keep primary care nurse practitioners and physician's assistants in a position where they can continue to provide the care that they have been and to develop new sites and new individuals who are interested in continuing to provide that care. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I too want to thank you for hearing this really important issue. My name is Madeline Simmons. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner in Bend, Oregon. I also have an office in Redmond, Oregon that serves clients from Prineville, Crooked River Ranch, and I see clients from Lakeview. So I have, while focused in Bend, I see clients from a number of rural areas. I've been in private practice for about 7 years. I've completed 2 graduate programs and been a nurse for over 25 years. My practice includes people ranging from 9 to 90 years old. My primary focus is adolescents. So I work a lot with young people transitioning into high school, out of high school, into secondary education. And as we know, a lot of mental health issues emerge at that time. So I enjoy working with young folks. I want to address 3 issues today. The first is the shortage of nurse practitioners or psychiatric prescribers willing to serve kids in Central Oregon. And I want to talk about the flow of clients between prescribers, whether they be psychiatrists or nurse practitioners. I want to talk about the billing codes, the new billing codes that address acuity really accurately. And then I want to talk about the impact of the 2010 cuts. Unfortunately, I was one of those people in the 10 to 20% that were cut, and it has affected my practice. Twice during my 7 years of working in Central Oregon, psychiatrists have left the area and gone to work somewhere else. The first time was right when I was starting my practice, and a psychiatrist sat me down in her office, went through a stack of her clients, turned them over to me. So it was a boost for my new practice, and I have carried those kids through high school and on to college. The second psychiatrist, The second psychiatrist who left was an osteopathic doc who actually left to come teach at Western Health Sciences University. I think maybe some of his students might testify. So he left to teach medical students and turned many of his clients over to me, and that was in his Redmond office. So I not only got many of his Redmond and Prineville clients, but I also got some of his state contracts with like probation and parole offices. So while we, speaking in front of you, can delineate nurse practitioners and PAs and doctors, the reality is in rural areas like Redmond, there's a very frequent flow between nurse practitioners and psychiatrists depending who has a practice in town and what their specialties are. I still collaborate with people, with the psychiatrists who left town on some tricky kids. So in smaller areas like Bend, there is a significant flow between prescribers with different educations. The good news is that their new billing codes that started January 1st that allow us to really differentiate the acuity of care. One rumor or misconception is that nurse practitioners see the easy ones and the psychiatrists see the hard ones. And some cases that's true. Other cases we see more complicated ones. The nice thing is that the American Psychiatric Association generated new billing codes so that the complexity of the client is very clearly delineated. So you can have an easier client, a moderate client, you can have a very complex client. And then you can bill for therapy based on the amount of time you spend in therapy. So we can now differentiate between an hour spent with a nice lady on an antidepressant with relationship issues and a floridly psychotic young person who needs to be hospitalized and is refusing to go. You might spend an hour with each client, but the nature of the interaction and the severity is quite different. So the new billing codes that came out in January really fairly, I think, address the acuity issues. I'll talk a little bit about how the practices look different. I'm part of a group of nurse practitioners in Central Oregon, and we see, on a busy day, we see at the most 12 clients. So we tend to spend a half hour, an hour with our clients. In the large psychiatric practice in town, people, they'll see up to 40 clients a day and do mostly medication management. So even if we're getting reimbursed fairly for our codes, we still aren't making as much money as they are. So we don't need to really worry about, this isn't about decreasing psychiatrist pay. It's about fairly reimbursing nurse practitioners who provide adequate services and skilled services to rural communities. and urban communities. Finally, I'd like to address the impact of the cuts on my practice. I received 25% cuts from several insurance companies. I've also opted not to be on panels for insurance companies that do serve a lot of clients in our area. That's limiting the amount of kids I have access to and the amount of people who have access to me. I turn away parents who have kids who have needs because it's really not financially viable for me to take them all on. It would be nice if there would be some way to make it so that I could, in my practice, serve more of these kids and keep them out of the emergency rooms. Again, I appreciate your willingness to address this issue, and I'm happy to take questions if you have any.
I'd like to know how many Medicaid clients you see in your practice and you see in your practice.
As a percent, we've looked at it, and we're around 10 to 12%. And we're right in downtown Portland. Now, part of the challenge is that we're, with the advent of the CCO model, we're starting to see that some of those patients are being run down different channels, and though we've had longstanding relationships with them, they're being put into other facilities for care. We've been able to work around that. We have thought that it was part of a responsibility that we had to serve some of the underserved population despite our location. Now, if I look at Southern Oregon, in Southern Oregon, our assistance population is closer to 20%, and Medicare is probably almost 30% there, which, of course, is a different issue, but also has reimbursement issues. Medicare is the one area at this point where there is already an 85% ceiling on payment to nurse practitioners compared to that with physicians. And we see a lot of those patients in Southern Oregon.
And how many providers in your practice?
In Portland, for primary care, we have four.
Okay,
one doc, three NPs.
Thank you. And you?
I was on the OHP panel, and then in Central Oregon, that changed so that the hospital got the contract for that. So currently, I have probably 20 clients on Medicare or OHP, and I see the OHP folks for free because I haven't done the paperwork to get on the new panel, and there's some restrictions there. So currently I'm providing, I'm donating, and because of the change in how OHP has been funded in Central Oregon.
And how many providers in your...
I'm the only provider. Okay. It's my own business.
Okay, thank you.
So,
other questions?
Yes.
Thank you. I don't know if you're the right person to ask this question to, Ms. King, and if you're not, I apologize, but you'll figure out who is. Are there other states that have had this problem and have addressed it in this way by passing statute about payment parity? Has that happened in other places in the country?
Chairwoman Sanderson and Senator Steiner Hayward, I don't have a comprehensive database of what's happening in all the states. However, this is a problem countrywide. And I do know that New Jersey is currently grappling with exactly this issue. I think they're in the process as well. So it is not an unfamiliar problem, but I can't answer it. I can certainly find out from you if that's an important piece of data that you would like. I'm happy to get that for you.
It would be helpful. I mean, I'm not unaware that there are other states grappling with this. Of course there are. The question is, how are other states choosing to deal with it? Because as we all go through this transformation, it's useful to learn from, to be in alignment to some extent with those states. Thank you. Madam Chair, may I ask one other question?
Yes,
if
please.
Anybody else wants to? And the Dash 10 amendments that got incorporated into the A-engrossed versions have a definition of independent practice in them. And I'm a little confused by that because, you know, I practice at OHSU, and our nurse practitioners all have NPI numbers. So I think by this definition, they would all be considered independent practitioners because they would all do their own, I mean, they'd all do their own billing as part of Epic, and they'd all have their own NPI numbers. So those of them who practice in our clinic at Gabriel Park would be considered independent practitioners under the language of the A-engrossed version. Is that correct?
Senator Mona Sanderson and Senator Steiner Hayward, that is correct.
Okay. So it's not what we would normally think of as independent people practicing on their own without, not part of a large group that includes physicians
right.
and other providers.
That's correct. It's not a solo practitioner. It is an independent practitioner as determined by the NPI.
Okay. I didn't think solo. I just meant independent, I think of as not part of a group that includes physicians and PAs and other people as well. That's just NPs. Thanks.
Okay, we've used almost 20 minutes of the time. We have about 2 minutes left. Jennifer Barr, Edwin Way, and Linda Morley.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Barr. I'm an RN and I'm a DNP student at the University of Portland. I'm starting my fourth and final year there as a Doctorate of Nursing Practice student, and I will graduate next May with my Family Nurse Practitioner degree. I have two bachelor's degrees in the four-year degree program, and I've been working as an RN for 5 years, so it gives me quite a bit of direct patient care experience. I would love to go into primary care, but House Bill 2902 is one of the ways that I can assure that I know I can afford to support myself and my student loan payments. I think primary care is important, and I think we all recognize that we're going to be needing more practitioners and more providers, and we have a shortage and kind of not very many solutions for that. So being a family nurse practitioner is one of the ways that I can help contribute to the health of Oregon by being in a primary care provider. There have been decades of studies that have consistently shown that nurse practitioners have similar, if not better, patient outcomes than physicians, and similar, if not better, patient satisfaction scores than physicians. I think it's just important to recognize that we need primary care providers, and nurse practitioners are one of the ways that we can get primary care to patients that don't have it and don't have access to it. And I really hope that you would consider passing House Bill 2902 in order to ensure that future cuts to nurse practitioner reimbursements are not allowed. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
A couple minutes left then.
Chair Mona Sanderson and Vice Chair Cruz, good to see you again, members of the committee. My name is Edwin Way. I'm a PA, and I truly am an independent remote site PA. I practice in the small town of Oak Ridge, Oregon. We have about 3,500 people in that town. I am now the only provider in that town. 5 years ago, we had two other clinics, and they could not maintain financial viability, primarily due to reimbursement issues, and they are now closed, and I am the only one standing. Was sent some letters by insurance companies stating that they were going to start following Medicare's lead and start discounting the reimbursement paid to me by 15% at least. And this bill will help prevent that. This is a proactive bill. Incidentally, as far as PAs go, we know that the state of Alaska and the state of Arkansas have bills that do not allow, that essentially the same bills, where PAs are paid at the same level and there's been no decrease in the reimbursement to physicians. I would like to say this is not about salary. This is not about payment to me. This is about reimbursement to the facility that I work in. Because I get paid 15% less does not mean that my nursing staff is willing to take 15% less pay. My medical supply house doesn't take 15%, and certainly my patients do not receive a 15% rebate from the insurance companies because they've come to see me. The insurance companies still demand that they pay their full fare. I see patients from 2 weeks old to 98 years old, and I heard the beep, and so I'm going to stop, but this is not about my payment. This is about keeping my clinic and PAs in general economically viable, because we're going to leave the state. People will go where they can make a living, and if we can't make a living, we will leave.
How many providers in your clinic?
Me.
Okay.
My physician shows up once a month to sign certain papers that Medicare and Medicaid require an MD's name on.
Okay. I don't have a practice yet, but hopefully I will at some point someday.
Right. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
With that, I would like to call up Robin, is it Dribble-Bus? Sharon Myron. And Heather Knott. And come quickly, because as soon as you start talking, and on deck when they're done is Tan No, Aaron Gray, and Dylan Ledford. Please begin.
I guess I will go first. Good afternoon, committee members, Chair Mona Sanderson, and all members of the committee. My name is Robin Drive-Elvis, and I'm the current president of the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon. I'm a practicing family physician for the past 15 years in a small solo or small group practice for family medicine. We have four physicians, a nurse practitioner, and a PA. So we have nurse practitioners and PAs as part of our team, and they are well thought of and a huge part of what we do on a daily basis. I would like to thank you for the opportunity to discuss our concerns with House Bill 2902. I am testifying today to urge your consideration to the alternatives of House Bill 2902A. I strongly support a compromise solution on House Bill 2902A that would restore payments to nurse practitioners and allow for a work group to develop a comprehensive plan to address Oregon's primary care workforce issues. I applaud the efforts to strengthen the healthcare workforce in Oregon, but nothing in this bill prevents insurers from reducing reimbursement to physicians in order to meet that payment mandate. And I am concerned that this bill, as written, may negatively impact the primary care physician workforce in the state of Oregon. I understand the impetus behind the bill was to address the payment cuts that were made to certain nurse practitioners by the commercial insurers. I fully support amendments to this bill that would restore payments to the nurse practitioners and develop a work group to come together for a meaningful long-term policy that improves the primary care network across all practitioner groups. The Dash 14 amendments are a win-win scenario and will allow for the comprehensive solution to address system inequities. The Heart of Osteopathic Medicine training programs involve taking a comprehensive view at all aspects that affect one's health. As an osteopathic physician, I don't just look at the patient's symptoms, but strive to understand the full picture of the circumstances and qualities that influence his or her ability to achieve their ultimate health. Just as we need to consider the patient as a whole and not just a set of symptoms, we also need to consider our healthcare system as a whole when considering system improvements. I've heard that this bill referred to as the nurse practitioner payment parity. Parity cannot be achieved by looking at just one aspect of the problem or the issue, such as reimbursement, while ignoring others, such as length of training programs, cost differences of those training programs, clinical experience, residency training requirements, costs of providing care, as well as malpractice insurance, as, among others. A work group addressing these qualities and issues can develop policy that takes into account the impacts of the entire primary care network. As an osteopathic physician, amendments to this bill are especially important to me, considering that osteopathic physicians have a strong history of serving primary care fields. Historically, the majority of osteopathic students have continued to serve in primary care fields across the state as well as across this nation. Unfortunately, the percentage of students entering the primary care specialties, as we would all hope that they would, has been decreasing for many, many reasons over the past few years. Undervaluing the importance of a strong primary care physician workforce will further push medical students into specialty fields. I urge you to value Oregon's primary care physicians and support the compromise solution to House Bill 2902. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to testify today. My name is Dr. Sharon Myron. I am an emergency room physician, and I'm a member of the OMA's legislative committee. I was also immediate past president of the Oregon College of Emergency Physicians. I want to say up front that I am fully in favor of the spirit of Senate Bill 2902. I regularly work alongside NPs and PAs. They are my colleagues and my friends. I fully believe in fairness and equity. I'm testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 2902 as it is written because in practice, it will have unintended consequences which will render it absolutely unfair and inequitable. It will have a devastating impact on primary care and mental health physician workforce at a time when workforce issues are one of the fundamental concerns during healthcare transformation. Breathe. thanks. So I agree that the cut to reimbursement rates for NPs and PAs was absolutely unfair and inappropriate. But rather than improve the situation for NPs and PAs, I believe that Senate Bill 2902 will actually bring everyone down. It has a fundamental flaw, in my view, that it mandates only that NPs, PAs, and MDs or DOs be reimbursed equally. When cutting costs is essential in this time of healthcare transformation, good business people who administer insurance, I would think that given the option of cutting reimbursement to physicians versus increasing all NPs and PAs reimbursement, they would favor the former. So they would move to decrease reimbursement for physicians, leaving NPs and PAs in exactly the same situation they are now, but it would make it much worse for practicing physicians. I know that right now it's difficult for medical students to go into primary care fields or into mental health fields because of the rigor of the training, the residency, everything that was already described. But people still do it despite tremendous barriers. I think this additional disincentive would put people over the edge and would have a devastating impact on our primary care workforce when we can't afford it. I do very much support the compromise position with the Dash 14 amendments that would both adjust the payments for NPs and PAs while a workforce is formed so that we can collaborate and absolutely work together, as we should, to come up with a holistic and appropriate addressing of this issue. So I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the privilege of allowing me to testify. So my name is Heather Knott. I work for the Oregon State Hospital. I'm an OHSU contract physician. I'm new to the state of Oregon, and I'm testifying here today to kind of echo what my colleagues have said, that I believe this bill is going to have unintended consequences. I come from a line of women in my family go into healthcare. My aunt is a nurse. My mom is a nurse practitioner. My grandma was a nurse. I fully support nurses and nurse practitioners, and I respect what they do. When I told my mom about this bill, her question for me was, well, why would anyone go to medical school? And then her second question was, are you sure you want to stay in Oregon? So I think that this bill has unintended consequences. So I urge you to think of other options. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, you all, I presume, support nurse practitioners, NPAs having an independent scope of practice, or nurse practitioners having an independent scope of practice?
Yes.
I
do.
You do? So I think what they're arguing is that it's kind of a cruel joke to say you can practice independently, but you're not going to be able to make a living at it. And I think that's really all they're arguing for, is they should be able to keep their doors open, don't you think?
Right. Well, I think that we're all on the same page with that. That's exactly why I said in the beginning I support the spirit of what this bill is intending to achieve. The bill as written does not do that. I think the bill as written, what it does, will keep things status quo for NPs and PAs, and will drastically worsen things for physicians, so that the only ones that are going to win, I think, are the insurance companies, to be honest. And I would fully support working with NPs and PAs to come up with something that says exactly what you said, so that the real, what we all want to achieve, is achieved. I don't think the bill as written does it. I think as amended, it can.
follow up? So, and I don't want to pick on you. I know that you all took time off of work to get here. If your lobbyists were here, I'd pick on them a lot more. But but my impression, and if anyone from the committee or wants to chime in, my impression of the Dash 14s is it locks in the 85%. And so I'm not sure how that actually helps nurse practitioners.
My understanding is, well, I'm not actually going to speak to it. We should talk to our lobbyists and our representatives.
And also, there's only 9 minutes left for six more people to speak. So let's have 10, Aaron, and Dylan come. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Monasanis and distinguished committee members, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you. My name is Dr. Tan Ngo, and I'm opposed to House Bill 2902A. I'm the current chief resident for the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Fellowship at Oregon Health and Science University. I also represent 800 future physicians as the past president of the OHSU House Officers Association. In this letter in my hand represents their opposition to this bill as well. I fully agree with all the folks who spoke before me, but I want to outline also why we as the future medical workforce for Oregon also stand here today to oppose this bill. First, this bill fails to recognize that it takes four times as long and three times the financial commitment to become a comprehensively trained physician compared to the training of mid-level providers, that is, nurse practitioners and physician assistants. My colleagues carry as much as $300,000 in debt, and choosing to go into primary care or psychiatry can be a difficult choice, considering how salaries in these areas are lower compared to specialty fields. Potential reductions in income that may come out of this bill, which is another unintended consequence, will make it impossible to recruit medical students to train in these fields in Oregon. It will also make retention and recruitment of physicians in Oregon nearly impossible for decades to come. 89% of trainees this year that came to OHSU came from other states, and with greater than 50% of them being women. Oregon depends on recruitment of outside physicians to staff its medical workforce, and this bill would really jeopardize that in a time of broad reform. This bill also falsely equates the limited scope of nurse practitioner and physician assistant training to the depth and length of training that physicians have. No nurse practitioner or physician assistant is required to spend 3 to 6 years in completing supervised clinical training, nor do they see the sheer volume of patients that we as physicians see in our training. They simply cannot have the comprehensive approach physicians bring to the diagnosis and treatment of patients. In conclusion, physicians really do want to work in multidisciplinary teams with nurse practitioners and physician assistants. Mid-level providers are really important, but they are not physicians, and we feel that they should not be paid as though they are. We residents urge you to vote no on House Bill 2902A. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak in front of you, and I would be happy to answer any of your questions.
Let's go through the panel. Thank you.
Senator Motis Anderson and the chair and through and the committee. This is my first time, so if I...
You're doing great.
I'll stumble my way through.
Don't worry.
My name is Stephen Litford, and I'm a third-year osteopathic medical school at Comp Northwest in Lebanon. I'm here today to speak in favor of the compromise solution to House Bill 2902. As a native Oregonian from Cornelius, I understand how important it is to have healthcare workers where we need it in rural areas. I think that what I really want to talk about is the advantages of the amendments to the bill. And I think that the amendments to the House Bill to 2902 would restore nurse I believe that the amendments do an excellent job of displaying is an excellent example of the osteopathic principles applied at the patient, provider, and system level. At the outset, these amendments take a bill that was created in reaction to payment cuts to nurse practitioners and changes the focus from protection of wages to a subset of healthcare workers to protecting the interests of all members of the healthcare team, as well as protecting the integrity of the dynamics within that team. Also, it encourages healthcare practitioners to provide care in areas where there's provider shortages. A couple weeks ago, I talked to a representative who voted yes to 2902, and I asked her why, and she said, "We need healthcare workers." And I think that we need to create something that helps everybody to get healthcare workers where we need them to be.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson and the committee, thank you for letting me testify today. My name is Erin Gray, and I am a first-year student at Western University of Health Sciences, Comp Northwest in Lebanon, Oregon. And I'm also in support of the amended bill 2902. I believe that a task force to solve the problems long term are more important than just a quick fix in adjusting reimbursement rates. I also want to emphasize the length of our training and the amount of debt that we as physicians will incur. By the time I pay back my loans, I will have paid about $300,000 and will have undergone almost a decade of training, not including undergraduate. And it is important to recognize that physicians do have the more extensive training than the nurse practitioners and physician assistants. And I also believe that primary care is very important, and I do not want to have a disincentive to go into primary care as a physician. And I believe that the bill as it stands would provide that disincentive. So thank you for your consideration. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Do you have questions for this panel? Okay, we have about 3 minutes left for Elise Brown, Betsy Earls, and Jan Meek. And maybe it'll take you 3 minutes to get up here.
They're slower than they used to be.
We all are, Senator.
That was an inclusive statement, okay.
Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have to talk really fast here to get my 60 seconds or less in, but thank you for the opportunity to be here today. Elise Brown, representing AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, and all its Oregon members. And we are here generally to oppose 2902 as it's written. You have before you or being distributed is a letter in opposition from AHIP, and I'm not going to detail everything that's in there. You can read that, but I think as a panel from the plan community and representative from the plan community, our biggest concern is adding cost to the system, and that's what we believe this bill will do. 2902, in a good way, seeks to increase access to healthcare services by NPs and PAs, but it does so with harmful effect and increasing costs for consumers and health insurance premiums. If plans are forced to pay NPs and PAs at the same level as physicians, premiums go up, bottom line. So then the incentive that we have now to utilize lower cost providers is diminished. We all value the services provided by nurse practitioners and PAs. In fact, for disclosure, I'm a mother, a proud mother of a young nurse, a BS nurse, and she's soon to explore the world of NPs. What we do want to do, though, is sit down with all the providers, nurses and PAs included, and come up with a reimbursement plan that's based on quality and not quantity. So the -14s are amendments that the plan community can support. One thing we really like in particular about the amendments is the creation of the task force, and we hope, I'm going to run out of time here, but I want to make sure that these guys get a chance to say something too. But I do want to, before I forget, in answer to Senator Steiner Hayward's question about any other state doing this, as far as AHIP understands, there is no other state that has payment parity for PAs and NPs. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. And in the interest of time, I will just get on the record that AOI opposes House Bill 2902 in the form it's currently written, but we would support the bill as amended by the -14 amendments. We have several members that are out in rural areas and depend heavily on
nurse practitioners and physicians assistants out there, and we feel that this is probably a good compromise for now in the Dash 14s.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Business, representing small businesses in Oregon. I'll make this very quick. I also stand at the same position as AOI does. We feel that nurse practitioners was evolved for the purpose of access and cost control, and that 2902 as it is written has a tendency to defeat that purpose. And we do have members in rural Oregon. We certainly are sensitive to that, and we want to have them have access to medical care at an affordable rate. We do support the Dash 14 amendments. Something that was, I would like to bring your attention to page 4 and line 11, where regarding the task force, where it says that it describes their tasks, and it says including but not limited to recommendations regarding insurance reimbursement for services provided by licensed physician assistants and certified nurse practitioners. So they will address reimbursement, which I would think does not necessarily lock in the 85% per going forward necessarily. And that's the purpose of the task force, is to look at and evolve a global plan in Oregon.
Thank you so much. Are there questions? All right. So what I would like to do now, thank you, panel. We have the Dash 14 amendments, and I believe there's a Dash 15 coming or 16 coming. And so...
Or 17 or 18.
So we will be having another... probably work session to just talk about whatever amendments are before us, and therefore we really need to have Gwen Dayton to explain the Dash 14s, and I'm not quite sure what the other amendments are going to be, but yes,
Madam
Senator
Chair,
Shields.
I just wanted to put on the record that I have a conflict in this, and that my wife is a nurse practitioner in an independent practice. I want to make sure that everybody knew that. But I'm supporting it not because of our own personal financial interests, but because I think that nurse practitioners around the state are likely to get squeezed out of business, and that will increase the health care costs of everybody when there's more consolidation in the primary care world.
Thank you, Senator Shields. So this topic, we will be spending a lot of time discussing the amendments, and I don't think it'll be next week, but possibly the fall. When's our last week? We have 2 weeks left.
Yes.
So something's going to happen within 2 weeks.
Plenty of time.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Knope.
I just wanted to say, based on the testimony that we heard today, it appears that we have both an urban problem and a rural problem. But what seems to be the common factor amongst all of them is it's a very small clinic problem. And I think if we narrowed our focus to small clinic, maybe under 10, I think we're getting more to the heart of the problem, because everyone who testified was either a sole practitioner or they were in a very small clinic. So I just wanted to put that on the record and see if we can't work to make this a bill that everybody could support.
Thank you very much. All right. Other comments? All right. Thank you very much, everyone. And again, Happy Nurses Week. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2902A and open a public hearing on 2092.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2092 comes to you from the House floor with 58 ayes, 2 excused. It requires the Oregon Health Authority to establish and administer injury and violence prevention program, continuously appropriates money received by gifts, grants, or donation to the authority for the purpose of administering the program, has an emergency clause effective on passage. There's no revenue or fiscal impact statement.
Thank you. Mel Cohn, Sybil Hebb, and Patty O'Sullivan.
No, I'm sure. I just want to say for the record, I'm against injury and violence. So. One does that, yeah. There may be exceptions.
It's in
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. And for the record, I'm Dr. Melcone. I'm the Director of Public Health and the State Public Health Officer, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2092. What this bill really does is to make explicit the legal authority for the health authority to continue to administer our existing injury and violence prevention program. This does not create a new program. This does not provide us any new money for this program. It's really a statement of support and endorsement of the work that we've been doing around injury and violence prevention, and an acknowledgement that this is a very important issue that as a community and as a state we should be addressing. We've had an injury and violence prevention program since 1997, and so it's a relative newcomer to the world of public health practice. But the reason it's so important, you may be surprised to learn that injury is the third leading cause of death overall in Oregon, the third. It's exceeded only by cancer and heart disease. And among people under age 44, it is the leading cause of death. In this age of healthcare reform, of course, injuries are major, major contributors to healthcare expenditures and healthcare costs. So this is a very serious problem, and public health tools can do a lot to save lives, prevent death and disability, and also save on healthcare costs. There's a certain fatalism about injuries in many quarters that, as the phrase goes, injuries are not accidents. In fact, they are predictable and preventable. We just have to be smart enough, as in any other kind of public health activity, to understand the causes of injuries and then put in place the prevention strategies that need to be there. And to do that, as in all of our public health activities, we use the core functions of public health, assessment, policy development, and assurance. So the assessment piece, of course, is understanding what is the problem, what's contributing to it, and there, you know, data collection is a key piece of that, analysis, understanding the issues related to injuries. Policy development, of course, that's you all are key players in all of that, providing some information that helps you do that kind of deliberation and come up with policies that are going to be effective, very, very important. And then finally, the assurance part is making sure that whatever policies we put in place are actually doing what they're intended to do. So the Institute of Medicine calls those three things the core functions of public health. With respect to injury prevention, that's the way we approach this work. Some of the areas that our injury prevention program has been involved in include child health and child safety, traffic safety, victim services, mental health, occupational safety. These are all places where injuries are very, very important. And some of our successes include work to protect children from bicycle injuries by promoting helmet use, support of Oregon's network of Safe Kids chapters around the state, collaboration with the Department of Transportation on highway safety issues, the development of a network of Tai Chi classes around the state to prevent falls in older adults. Falls are incredibly costly, both in personal and financial terms for all of us. The issuance of data reports on suicide. It's another area. Suicide. We have more suicide deaths in Oregon than we have motor vehicle crash deaths every year. Prescription drug overdose, and I know Sybil's going to talk about some of the work that our program's done in collaboration with folks involved in preventing intimate partner violence or domestic violence. So we believe that our program, together with our partners, has been an important contributor to the 53% reduction in child injury that Oregon has seen since 2000. So if we have such a great program, why do we need this bill? Well, again, just to reiterate what I said before, this would be a clear and explicit statement by the legislature of support of the full range of public health practice activities related to injury prevention, and frankly also a statement of encouragement to our partners who are working out in the community, often, you know, fairly lonely around that, so that this is a really, that their work is very, very important. In addition, our injury prevention program is almost entirely funded with federal grants. Having an explicit explicit endorsement by the legislature of this work is going to be very, very important for us going forward, particularly as federal funds get tighter and tighter, sequestration and so forth. The competition for these funds is going to be more and more intense, and having support, clear, explicit support from the legislature is very important. The one last thing I want to say, this bill has passed out of the House, so now it's before you. When we testified in front of the House committee, we talked with Patty O, who you're going to hear from in a minute, about trying to find some amendment language that we could all live with to address some concerns around the burden of data collection. And we haven't yet been able to craft that language, but I'm not ready to throw in the towel yet. We're going to continue to talk and see if we can come up with something that is agreeable to everybody and is going to accomplish all of the objectives that we're looking for. So in summary, I think this bill is an important endorsement of public health practice in a very, very important area for our state, and I hope that should we have a work session in the future, that you all will go ahead and support it moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kwan.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm an attorney and policy director at the Oregon Law Center, which is a statewide provider of civil legal assistance to low-income people. You may be wondering why I'm here on this bill. The issue is that it's the unfortunate reality that a significant number of our clients, a significant number of people who call our offices seeking help, are doing that because they are victims of domestic or sexual violence. It's almost 40% of our family law cases are as a result of domestic violence or sexual assault in the home, and a number of our other kinds of cases related to safe housing and employment and administrative benefits are related to that need that's caused by the fact that a person has been a victim and is seeking safety. And we can't do our work without the incredible work that the Health Department and OHA provide and the support that we provide for us. We're extremely committed to the coordinated community response to preventing domestic and sexual violence, because we want to cut down on the driver that's bringing clients into our doors. We want to support the work of our community partners who are helping to do that, and we can't do it without one another. So the partnership that the Health Authority has provided to us in facilitating those conversations has been incredibly important. Dr. Cohn mentioned that injury is the third leading cause of death in this state. What some may not know is that domestic and sexual violence is an incredible driver of those injuries. One in three women in Oregon report suffering serious domestic or sexual violence in their lifetime. We actually have a recent study by the CDC conducted showed that we have the highest rate of sexual assault in the nation, or second highest, I believe, second only to the state of Alaska. We don't know why that is. We'd like to get on top of why that is so that we can do a good job of preventing that and changing that. And if we don't have the data that helps us understand where that's coming from and what that's about and what the right way is to respond, we're not going to get on top of that and bring that number down. Just in the last year alone, you may not know that 40 Oregonians died as a result of domestic violence. It is 25% of all homicides in Oregon are as a result of domestic violence, and nearly 45% of female homicides are as a result of domestic violence. So this is a huge issue that has an impact on individuals, their families, their children, and our communities. And so we are very supportive of this bill as a means of allowing the Health Department or the Oregon Health Authority to make sure they have access to those grants so that they can provide directed assistance, and also we'd like to facilitate their collection of data. For just a couple of examples of data that we're interested in, the Law Center is a participant along with OHA and DHS, the Department of Justice, in a fatality review team, domestic violence fatality review team. And that's one example of where we're all putting our heads together to try to figure out how can we examine these fatalities as they're happening, what is it that we're seeing as trends, what's the data around those trends, and what are the ways that we can direct our resources so that we can prevent those homicides. Another piece that I'm really interested in, and I think we all are as a community and as a state, is the concern that domestic and sexual violence have lifetime impact on teens and children. If kids are growing up in homes where there is violence and they're a part of that or they're injured by that or observing that. There are lifelong substance abuse, mental health abuse, physical safety issues we struggle to address moving forward. We know that the cost of domestic and sexual violence in Oregon is about $50 million a year. So better directing our resources to that prevention has a huge impact on our state budget as well. We don't know enough about what it looks like in the schools and how teens are struggling with this. We don't ask enough questions. We don't have good enough data on that element. We'd like to learn more about that so that we can get in early and help prevent that cycle of violence. So I guess I would just close in saying that I really appreciate all of the incredible work and dedication you've all shown to healthcare transformation in this state. And healthcare transformation is about partnership and collaboration. And there's no place that I'm aware of in Oregon that is that it's more important to facilitate that collaboration and that partnership. Domestic and sexual violence are maternal child health issues, their learning issues, their mental health issues, their chronic disease issues, their emergency room issues, their law enforcement issues, their primary care issues, the whole gamut. And so anything that we can do to support the work of the health authority in better addressing that is very much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Sybil.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And I am right now at this very second neutral on this bill. However, I will say that as for the policy of the bill, the association, we understand it. We are supportive. You know, I worked for the Department of Human Services for many, many years and worked on these programs with Mel, and since then have worked with his staff on some trauma, stroke, all kinds of programs with him. So we're not opposed to the bill per se. What we're opposed to or what we have a concern with is data fatigue. So we're looking to develop an amendment that both Mel and ourselves can live with that talk about if this bill is just codifying current programs, then we would like something that says that's great. But if there is new data that is needed, then you either need to come back here. For instance, traumatic brain injury, there's been a bill about traumatic brain injury a couple of times, and it hasn't passed. If you didn't hear this testimony and you thought these were new authorities, then you would think that they could just say, now you're going to go give us traumatic brain injury data. What we want to just say in the statute is that this codifies the current prevention programs. There's a lot of them in public health, and if there are any new ones, you need to come back here and talk about it, because we're just inundated with data requests right now, with CCOs, with all kinds of things. We have a stroke bill. We agreed upon the submitting the data on the strokes for all the big hospitals, so when we have the conversation, we're normally fine with it. I think part of this goes back to something that happened when many years ago, a number of years ago anyway, a trauma registry was codified, and we agreed to it. And everybody started submitting data. In fact, one of our big systems had to hire 4 people to collect and submit that data for the trauma registry. We finally passed 6 years ago, we finally got our first report out of that data registry this year. And the reason is we were giving it, they were collecting it, but they had no staff to analyze it, to put anything together that says, what does this data tell us? It's great to collect it, but you have to do something with it. And and if you want to help people, somebody's got an epidemiologist has to analyze it. Luckily, we were able to get Dr. Cohn some funding last February for that to do that data analyzation, and it has happened. We're finally getting reports. But it put a little bit of a bad taste in our mouth to say it's great to ask for it and collect it. That puts all the the problem in our court, and then we don't see any results from it. And that goes for clinics, it goes for doctors, it goes for nurses, anywhere you want to collect data, not just hospitals. So we're trying to work out an amendment. We're very supportive of the bill if we can work out an amendment, and hopefully we can. We were just out in the hall all talking, and we're getting a little bit closer. So I will be very happy if we can, and I'll come back and fully support the bill if we can.
Thank you. You know that with the coordinated care organizations, there's a lot of data that we are going to need because we want to focus on the high users and we want to get into prevention. And this is, I don't know where this falls within the metrics for the CCOs, but it is critical for CCOs to be taking a look at how they can help prevent some of these injuries and violence. And so I know you're against it now, but and I'm not quite sure which route to go because I support data, but then I'm biased. I'm a public health nurse. I have to support this kind of thing because prevention is key. Yes, yeah, Senator Cruz.
By the same token, we are also attempting not to burden these new fledgling CCOs with a whole lot of reporting requirements. You know, the data they're going to have to report now is, well, we still don't know everything that's in there. And you know, what we don't want to do is replicate what happens in doctors' offices now where they have to have three or four people just to mess with paper, and it isn't healthcare. So there has to be a balance in here as well.
Chair Mona Sanderson, I did want to add that one of the versions of our amendments so far did include a stipulation that said, talked about checking on where else the data may be available.
Yeah.
And again, CCOs are only Medicaid. Injuries happen to their incidents, actually, in or OSHA language. There's no such thing as an accident. We have to report all over. We report to federal government. We report to state. We report to OOPR. We report all over the place. And so one of the things about, do you want new data? Come to us. Is it collected anywhere else? Does that satisfy your need? Can we just get it from that other entity? And if it's brand new data, what are we going to do with it? When are we going to do that? And what's the problem? And that's all we're really talking about, is a conversation ahead of time. We're not opposed to data if it's going to help, you know, prevent injuries at all. It's just, we just have data fatigue right now. And we just want to make sure that we're very careful and that we make a conscious decision together in a collaboration before we start collecting more.
Chair Mona Sanderson, I want to say on the record that I'm very sympathetic to the data fatigue issues that Patty's raising. I think that putting in place, even in statute, a requirement that we first look to see if these data are already available to us in some other way so that we don't have to actually ask anybody to give us anything new would be completely fine with us. And similarly, if there were to be some new requirements or something like that, working collaboratively with stakeholders to achieve exactly the balance that Senator Cruz talks about. I think while I appreciate the issues around data fatigue that are being raised, I think public health itself, so I'm not talking now about Medicaid or some of the other federal requirements from CMS and so forth, I think we have quite a good record of doing this in a collaborative way. And frankly, it's because we don't really have any other way to do it. We need the cooperation of the people who are going to be reporting data to us, in part also because the data will be better when they are, you know, engaged and feel that they're going to get something useful out of it. That is a very core principle to what we strive to do. So, you know, this is the kind of discussion that we've been having, and I hope we can come up with some language that will address that. I would be very, those ideas I am very comfortable with. What I don't want to do is put in place something that either reduces the current authorities that we have around data, or puts a straitjacket on us going into the future that is not a reasonable way to move forward. So that's the sort of balance that I hope we're going to be able to achieve.
And just a reminder, we only have 2 weeks, and so the amendment needs to be out, I would hope, be submitted next week so that hopefully we can get it by the end of the week so that we can get a fiscal, you know, if there is one. There won't be. Okay. Well, that's good. But so all I can say is time is of essence, so thank you. Yeah, Senator Cruz.
Just, you know, with all the new data and all, we still don't, I mean, the CCO, the metrics that are being required by OHA, I don't think have still been fully fleshed out as to what all that is. And there may be a nexus in some of that, too. So I think having a conversation with that shop might be helpful in this, because I would think that some of that data may be, you know, because prevention and all of these things that we're supposed to be measuring, there may be a something in there, because we don't want to be doing the same thing three or four different places. So.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will close public hearing on House Bill 2092 and just briefly open a public hearing on House Bill 2165A, which we don't really need.
She's still following me around.
I know. Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, State Representative from House District 16, fan of Senator Cruz. I follow him everywhere that he goes, and that is why I'm here today.
Does your husband know this?
Well, he does watch on TV sometimes if I'm late getting home.
We behave ourselves, for the record. So.
Okay. House Bill 2165 is a great bill that you don't need to pass because it is encompassed in lines 7 and 8 of House Bill 2205, which I hope that you do pass. This lifts the sunset on the county multidisciplinary teams that look at abuse of elderly and disabled adults. House Bill 2205 is the bill that Representative Gilliam, Representative Hoyle, and Senator Johnson have been working on. And if you pass that bill, we don't need this bill.
Okay.
So I urge you not to vote on it.
Okay. We will not carry it through. And we're just looking quickly on 22. Oh. It's in judiciary.
2205 is in judiciary.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. I will follow Senator Cruz there and make sure that gets taken care of. And I hope to be back with you soon on a different bill.
Okay. Right. Thank you, Representative Gelser. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2165A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2093A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2093A comes to you from the House floor votes with, yes, you guessed it, 60 ayes. Makes changes to provisions of law relating to vital statistics to reflect the 2011 revision of Model State Vital Statistics Act. It appropriates fee monies collected under the provisions to the Oregon Health Authority for the purpose of administering these provisions, and it becomes operative January 1, 2014. There's a minimal fiscal impact on the bill and no revenue impact.
Madam Chair, I have a question on Section 54, page 51, line 36, but we'll get to that.
Okay. Jennifer Woodward and Bruce Bishop.
Does Bruce prep you on that?
No, I did that all on my own. It's a typical Cruz thing, actually, so...
Thank you, Senator Monis-Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Woodward, and I'm the State Registrar for Vital Records from the Oregon Health Authority Public Health Division. And I'm here today to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2093A. It's related to vital statistics. This bill, we've incorporated suggestions from a variety of our colleagues, from the Oregon Funeral Directors Association, State Archives, Circuit Courts, Council of Local Health Officials, and also the genealogical community as well. House Bill 2093A is referred to in public health as the Vital Records Modernization Bill. This bill reorganizes and updates the Oregon Vital Records and Vital Statistics Law. And as you can see, and as Senator Cruz hinted, the bill is long. It's 74 pages long. It really is a model based on a model law. It's a reorganization based on a model law. And this model law was developed in 2009 through 2011 by a collaboration of the Federal Agency of Vital Records as well as a professional association of vital records and public health statistics. The last time there was a model law was in 1992. And Oregon actually implemented that model law in 1997. So that's the last time we've had to update our vital records law. As you know, a lot has changed since 1997. The model law and our current law accounts for changes in technology, security, and parentage. So our current law, for example, does not address any emerging issues such as an emerging area such as electronic records, electronic processes for registration and issue of records, electronic security and physical security of records, birth records when parents are of the same sex, and amendments to birth certificates following a sex change. Now, the bill is large. It's rather daunting, but 80% of the bill is current law. What it does is the bill simply reorganizes and clarifies the law to make it easier to follow and make it easier to understand. And there is no fiscal impact on this bill. Before I go into it, it is 80%, but I'd like to highlight some of the changes that we are making, because there is about 20% that there are some changes. First, new language has been added to improve security and confidentiality of vital records and vital statistics. And it's really important that Oregon have a secure vital records because these records, especially birth certificates, are the key documents to establish identity and verify citizenship. Restricted access to these records, secure electronic systems, and a clear history of how the records are changed are needed to continue confidence and usefulness of vital records. And House Bill 2093A, it keeps the confidential time frames for the records that have been in law since the 1970s. I know that many genealogists, when we were at the House, had comments about we were planning on changing the time frame, but we are going to keep this as in current law, and that has been in law since the 1970s. The second, the bill will improve registration of death certificates. Death certificates need to be registered in order for families to take care of family the affairs, to get insurance, to get Social Security. Also, you need to have the death certificate registered in order to get public health information, including influenza deaths, and, for example, some of the information that Dr. Cohn mentioned around injuries that are on the death certificates. You need to have those death certificates registered, and they need to be registered timely. We currently have an electronic death registration system, and we also still have quite a few of our death certificates that are in paper form. And in paper form, the records take 29 days on average to be registered. If they're on the electronic system, it takes approximately 6 days. And so this bill is requesting to be put in law that hospitals where they have 10 or more deaths would be using the electronic death registration system, which will improve the cause of death and then also let us register the death certificates and more timely. Death registration will also be improved because it allows death certificates to be completed and signed by the decedent's primary medical care provider for Oregonians who receive medical care in Washington, Idaho, and California. Currently, if you are you're receiving care in Washington, California, or Idaho, and your physician is licensed in those states, and then you die in Oregon, your physician cannot sign the death certificate. This law allows those physicians in contiguous states to sign those death certificates, which will improve the cause of death information because the physician is signing it, as well as the registration of the death. Finally, the bill streamlines the section in law on requirements needed to change the item on a birth certificate that indicates the sex. The sex on a birth certificate can be changed based on a court order that the person has completed sexual reassignment from one sex to another rather than requiring surgical procedures. So in summary, House Bill 2093A will improve the vital statistics and vital records system, and we will be the first state in the nation to implement the 2011 model law. So I'd really like to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? I would just like to make a comment if I could, Madam
Chair.
I commented in one of the earlier hearings today that sometimes being the first in the nation, or I imply that sometimes being the first in the nation to do something isn't such a great idea. In this case, yay you.
Thank you.
It's a good time to be first in the nation. This is a good law.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Our medical examiners, will they be going to the electronic as well, or are they still, because they do death certificates as well?
Senator Cruz and Senator Monis Anderson, the medical examiners, most of the medical examiners do use the electronic death registration system. We have a few that we need to get on. That is part of our working on that. But the medical examiners, most of them do use
it. If we go to the regional system, it'd make it easier for you, wouldn't it? We had a conversation about that. So the only other thing, Madam Chair, is, you know, I was here in 97 when we did this before. It's a shame we're doing it again so soon. But
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, Senior Counsel for Northwest Permanente. And we're here to support one issue that Ms. Woodward already addressed. It's the signing of the death certificates. 2 years ago, a number of our physicians got letters from the state saying that they could no longer sign death certificates for their patients who died in Oregon. The solutions that the state offered then were have an Oregon physician sign the death certificates or get an Oregon license. Neither of those were acceptable solutions to our physicians who practice in Longview and only have Washington licenses, but who see many patients who come across from Oregon. We raised that issue with the health division. We're pleased that they responded. House Bill 2093 fixes that problem, and we support the bill for that reason. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Other comment?
I wouldn't want somebody else signing my death certificate. I mean, seriously, I wouldn't want that as a physician.
What?
Another physician signing a death certificate of a patient I cared for. I think that's just flat out wrong.
Our physicians agreed with you, Senator.
I do have one specific question, and it's from somebody that lives in Nehalem. And do you have the bill in front of you?
I need to go grab it.
This is in Section 32, mm-hmm. ORS 432.115, Paragraph 4, and that is removed, and the removal. She says, I object to the amended language in Section 32, ORS 432.114, Paragraph 4, and the removal of Section 33.ORS 432.121, Paragraph 2C. And then she goes on to say, genealogy is a hobby of mine, and while I appreciate the need for protection of individual privacy, removal of birth, death, marriage, and divorce records from any access for such an extended period is detriment to researching improving family lines.
Okay. The one of the things that we are doing, so currently in law, we have the birth records are actually, and they have been in law since 1970s, the birth records are closed up to 100 years mm-hmm. after the birth, and the rest of the records are closed until 50 years after. We had originally planned to extend that. We do have what we call the public death abstracts that are available at the counties, and we are not making those public anymore. And the birth records and birth records abstracts have not ever been public. The mother actually has to indicate that she wants her birth information released. But the death records are public records at the county level, the vital records. So that's probably the section that she's referring to.
So those that are doing genealogy, they have had the opportunity to get that information now, and now they will not be able to?
At the county level, yes. But they have to go into each of the individual counties and go ask to see the county abstracts to see those.
And this bill will prevent that?
Yes.
But they can still get access.
They can get access after 50 years after the death, yes.
50 years after.
Yeah.
Well, most genealogists, I mean, that's when they would need it.
Yeah.
They would need it, yeah.
But you're changing that to 100 years?
No.
It's
going to stay what's in current law. It's 100 years for birth certificates and 50 years for death certificates, marriage and divorce certificates.
Right. Thank you.
I got a lot of those.
Okay.
Marriage and divorce certificates.
TMI, Senator.
Did you?
Okay, yes, Senator
Knope. Yeah, I've been listening to what you've been saying, And I had a question as it relates to changing a birth certificate for a sex change. Could you explain a little further, and if you could point me to the right section of the bill for that, please?
Okay, it's section, I believe it's on page 34, lines 16 and 17.
Damn, you're good.
So currently, under our current law, we require a court order. And we require a court order to change the sex on the birth certificate. We also require court orders to change many portions of the birth certificates. And currently, in law, the way it's required is that the court order needs to indicate that the person who's going through the sex change has gone through a complete surgical procedure. And the procedures have changed quite a bit, and so what we are now saying is that we still have to receive a court order, and the court order needs to specify that they have completed a sexual reassignment. So the difference is the surgical procedures versus the sexual reassignment. But we do still require a court order.
Can I follow up on that?
Yes.
Are there any other instances where you change birth certificates?
Could you
explain those, please?
Sure. Sorry. Senator Knopp and Senator Mona Sanderson, we do change legal birth certificates regularly. Name changes, for example. If you're going in and you want to change your name and you'd like to change your birth certificate, we do require a court order for that. We have an amendments unit that just focuses on changing records, and the main changes to those records are birth certificates. There are various rules and laws, and in this bill, we are really making it very clear when those birth certificates can be changed and what evidence needs to be changed. For example, prior to the first year of birth, it's much easier to change the birth certificate versus after the first year of birth. And when you are making major changes to a legal record such as a birth certificate, we really need to have appropriate evidence. We also do adoptions, is actually making a new birth certificate, and paternity establishment, adding fathers onto the paternity to the birth certificate. We do over 15,000 paternity establishments every year, and that is adding a father onto a birth certificate. And so it's considered changing that birth certificate.
No other further comment.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know that they're currently doing that, but it just seems odd that we would be changing factual information about what happened at birth. But I'm going to have to give it some more thought.
Okay. All right. Was this just for public hearing?
That's it. I'm slightly disappointed that Katie King didn't come and testify.
Okay.
But other than that,
yeah. Is the committee feel comfortable moving this bill?
I am.
Sure. Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2093A and open a work session on House Bill 2093A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2093A to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2093A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hubert.
Aye.
Sure.
Aye.
Senator Shields.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2093. And is there anything else on the agenda? We're adjourned.